Before we get this show on the road, I just want to once again say thank you so much for your incredible support through Patreon, donations, signing up for my membership, my website Light on Conspiracies, or my newsletter. Also, buying my books also helped to finance this, so thank you so much. And now, let's get going.
Welcome to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Your host, Peace Award-winning researcher Ole Damagod. To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe.
I'm here today with my dear friend Mike Williams, who is the host and founder of Sage Okwei Radio. I've had the honor and pleasure of being on his show several times, and I hope today that he will share some of his knowledge around hypnosis, but also a topic I know interests him very much, the case of Paul McCartney or Paul McCartney. But first of all, welcome to the show, and please tell us a little bit about how you came to this point in life.
Well, I had really two awakenings, Ole, going back to 2006. So the first one was really I had some personal challenges in my life, which made me have to look in the mirror and take stock of myself and essentially put myself on a different path. So that was in 2006. And then in 2009, there was like a phase two of an awakening, which was more spiritual in nature. So those two events that took place in my life really took me off the path that I was on. And I was like everybody else, or most everybody else. I was on the path of walking around in the matrix and unawake, and that shifted everything over. And once I made that shift, the spiritual aspect of my awakening really got a lot of traction. So I started to become very interested in spiritual understandings, and that led me to take a look into becoming a hypnotherapist. So that's what I am today. I'm a professional certified master hypnotherapist. And my practice, I do a lot of spiritual regression and that type of work. It's very fulfilling. Then what happened was, as I was going down that path, I started to really spread my wings and become more aware of everything else that was going on. So I look at the spiritual aspect of it as really the foundation in which I was going to build my new house. And going back a few years back, I want to say it's probably 4 or 5 years now, I started the blog, and I was doing that first, and then I was doing shows that had to do with hypnosis. I was being asked to come on and talk about past lives and life between lives and clinical hypnosis, and I was doing that. And one of the shows that I was on a couple of times was the Bob Charles Show, and Bob was a follower of my blog, and I didn't know that. And he had said to me offline, he said, "Hey, Mike, why don't you do a show that has to do with the content on your blog?" And I was very resistant to it. I'm like, I don't think I want to do that. I like just doing the blog the way it is, and I have my practice and so on. And so he kept at it. He kept pressing me to do it. He said, "I think it's really going to be a good thing. I think people will like it." So finally I said, okay, I'll do it. And I did it on his show. I started off on the Pyramid One Network, which is what Bob runs, and I was doing live shows. And then I did that for a while, and I couldn't do the live shows anymore because with everything else going on in my life, I just couldn't do this scheduling thing where, you know, once a week at this time I was going to do this. Because a lot of the guests that I wanted to bring on, like yourself or Max Egan or anybody that's in Europe and so on, the time differential really got in the way. So I decided that I was just going to do my own thing and pre-record the shows and upload them to YouTube and Mixcloud and put them on my blog and so on. And that was about 3.5 years ago. So it's 3.5 years later, and here I am doing the shows. And I have, I think, over 200 and something shows uploaded to my YouTube channel. So that's how it all began.
Give me love.
what woke me up as far as conspiracy research was, like with most people, it was 9/11. And I can't even pinpoint the moment in time when I started looking into 9/11. Initially, when it happened, I believed the government story. And it was not until a few years after that where I started running across information or coming across information where I was thinking to myself, well, what is this all about? And I started looking and I started doing more research. And so when I did that, I would try to present this information to, you know, friends and family. And I found out quickly that most people did not want to even consider it. It just wasn't something they wanted to look at. And that became frustrating after a while, because you're there, all you want to do is say, you want to show them some information that you've come across, and you want to show it to them because you're thinking, well, you're going to be interested in this too. And you find out that most people are not interested. And you soon, you know, realize that you're a lone wolf in many cases. So it's difficult at first. And in the beginning, it causes a lot of friction and tension, and it could get sometimes very angry. But I've gotten past all of that. I'm at the point today where my attitude is, look, it's here. It's here for you to look at. It's here for you to try to understand. If it's not something that resonates with you, or if you're not ready, then that's just the way it is. You know, I'll just move the work forward, and those people that are interested, they'll pick up on it and they'll look at it. And there's no sense in trying to evangelize or try to hammer it into people's heads. That approach just does not work.
Mike, if I remember right, you told me that you come from a family with strong bonds to the police force. Is that correct?
Well, my dad was a cop. Yep. So so I was around a lot of police growing up, because a lot of my father's friends, and I had other family members on my father's side of the family which were police. So I was very acclimated and very comfortable being around law enforcement. And I used to listen to all the stories. You know, we'd have these barbecues in my backyard, and, you know, Dad would have his friends and some of my uncles over, and my cousins who were also cops. And, you know, I would just take in the stories, which as a kid I used to find very fascinating, you know. So, so I was pretty acclimated to the law enforcement environment at home. They are as conditioned as everybody else out there. So they're living in the matrix also. They're watching the news at night. They're reading the newspapers. They're listening to the radio. So they're constantly being bombarded with the falsehoods and the deceptions and the half-truths that are coming out. And the thing is, like, if you look at the average street cop, right, they're dealing with issues. Let's say they're in narcotics as an example. So they're dealing with drug dealing. They're dealing with seeing people lying dead on the floor from overdosing. So what happens is they're seeing the outcome of this very wicked agenda. They're seeing the end result, which is that there's death, there's depravity, there's dysfunction. And so the average law enforcement policeman walking the beat or in his car or whatnot, I'm going back, especially going back to when my dad was, you know, on the police force, going back into the 60s and the 1970s, because he used to tell me about, you know, some of the stories about walking into crime scenes and what he had, you know, what he had witnessed or what he had to take in and what he had to deal with. So I think what happens is that they are in the trenches and they've got their heads underwater, basically dealing with this element of crime and, again, the dysfunction in society. And so I think that they don't have the time to pick their heads up to say, oh, you know what, I think a lot of this stuff is the outcome of some orchestrated or engineered event. So I do cut the police some slack, especially when I go back to that time in history. And I'm, again, folks, back to the 1960s and the 1970s and even into the 1980s. Because I know my father wasn't, you know, he wasn't playing any part in any drill. I know this, you know, I mean, it's my dad, and, you know, we used to do a lot of stuff together, and he was a little league coach and all that. So, I mean, it's just that they are victims of the barrage of contaminated information that makes its way out into the media. Now, I mean, fast forward today, though, you know, when we see some of these events, only that you and I have covered on my show, I do think it begins to become a different story, that there are players that are in quote-unquote law enforcement that really do understand what's going on, and they are part of the theater that's taking place. But I kind of view that piece of law enforcement that's in the know about these orchestrated events as a core group, and it's rather small, that there are, of course, the police force itself, and I'm talking about the police force in the United States because that's, you know, that's where I'm at. A lot of those cops, I don't think that they know. I don't think that they know. I think that they're playing their role with regard to doing their job. So maybe they have to go direct traffic. Maybe they have to go talk to people. Maybe they have to, you know, do whatever it is they have to do as part of their job description. But as far as being in the know, I tend to believe that a vast majority of them are not in the know. They are being actually directed unknowingly when we come down to these orchestrated events. So I mean, that's, I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what I think. I think that a lot of them are just, you know, they're victims of the matrix. They are believing the stuff that's being presented to them.
I don't need you after me. I know my way back home, so please go away, let me be. And I'll drink what I want to drink. I don't need your ball and chain. And I'll think what I want to think. And I think, yeah.
When you watch television, and especially when you're watching the cable news networks like Fox News and CNN and MSNBC and so on, it's all about hypnosis. So what they do, Oli, is they play loops all the time. So what the first thing you have to understand about hypnosis is that the inner mind or the unconscious, subconscious mind, it loves imagery. In fact, in my line of work, we say that imagination is the language of the subconscious / unconscious mind. So the first thing that they do is they have to present to the audience, they have to present the imagery. Now what's happening is because your mind loves the imagery. This is how you learn. You learn through imagery. They're taking it in. Then what happens is you get the words underneath the images, and you'll have words like alert, terror, bombing, shooting. So you're getting these one or two word blurbs that are going out while you're watching the television. So now what's happening is you are now connecting the suggestions. These are, well, I guess you would say verbal suggestions that are being matched with the imagery or the video that you're watching. Now, while they do this, a lot of times what you'll see is you'll see a ticker tape at the bottom where they're supposedly giving you, you know, the stock prices or the stock market changes that are going on. That's not what it's about. Or you might see a rotating logo for Fox News or, you know, some other news network. That's done in order to bring about what we refer to as eye fixation. So when you have eye fixation, you watch that, then what happens is you start to get eye fatigue. And once you have eye fatigue, you're now entering and have entered into a trance state, and you've entered into what we refer to as alpha state. You have four states, general states of awareness, conscious awareness. You have beta, which is your waking state, your conscious state like you and I right now. You have alpha, which is you start getting into a light trance state. You have theta, which is a deep trance state. And then you have delta, and delta is essentially sleep. Media operates in alpha state. And because alpha state is a light trance state, what happens is in order to condition the person's mind, it has to be repetitive. And it has to go on and on and on and on. Because in light trance states, you need more of that programming in order for the programming to start to get traction and become a part of your thinking and your thoughts. So when you're watching the news, you're watching, let's say, Fox News, and you see the little logo spinning on the right-hand side of the screen, and then you see the ticker tape going across the bottom of the screen, and then you're seeing the loops of a bombing, of a shooting, of emergency workers, of a burning building. And then you have the person speaking, the talking head, the so-called anchor person, anchor meaning anchoring the suggestions. You have that playing out. You're getting the whole nine yards in one shot. This is why when, if you go back to 9/11, they would constantly show the towers coming down. They're constantly showing that. We're constantly showing the planes hitting the buildings. Or afterwards, they would show the same old clips of Osama bin Laden. And what they were doing is they were programming you. programming you to just remember the buildings coming down, to remember planes hitting the building, and for you to remember the boogeyman. And they do this all the time. They still do it. That's why I think you and I spoke about this before. They will show with these false flags, as an example, they will show the same imagery, the same video clip over and over and over again. And the average person would be thinking to themselves, Jesus, is this the only piece of footage that we have? Well, it's the only piece of footage they're going to show you because it's part of a it's part of a programming process that's taking place. And they do use colors. They love blue and red. Blue and red is, these are Masonic colors, number one. So there's a couple of reasons why they use blue and red. One is that in Freemasonry, we have blue lodges and red lodges. The color red represents power. The color blue represents balance. And also, blue and red have an effect on the human mind. So when a human takes a look at the color blue, blue represents calmness, relaxation. It also elicits generosity. That's why a lot of the big box stores like Walmart and Sam's Club and so on, they have a lot of blue. Well, blue means generosity, which means that you're more apt to spend money when you're in an environment where you see a lot of blue. Red, on the other hand, is a color that the mind interprets as a warning, as an alert that you need to be aware, to take caution. So you'll see this a lot. You'll watch two talking heads, two pundits talking on one of the fake news outlets, and one person, let's say a woman, has a red dress on, and then she has a point counterpoint with another person who's a guy. It's dressed up in blue, and he has a blue tie on. So you have the whole red and blue dynamic going on. Take a look at any one of the TV networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and then cable news, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and all you're going to see is this red and blue coordinated color scheme going on. So that's what's happening. They're using it for multiple reasons. One, they're Masonic colors, so that they're basically flashing and making it known to their adepts and to the brotherhood that they're in control. And the other thing is blue and red has a definite effect psychologically on humans. And so when you get like things like alert, terror alert, you're going to see a lot of red. There's going to be a lot of red. You're going to see red ties if they're going to be talking to somebody. Or let's say the anchor person or the reporter is a woman. She's going to be wearing a red dress. Or the background on the set of the news network is going to be decked out in mostly red. You'll see some blue also, but mostly red. If they want to get a point across, which that particular news organization is leaning toward or favoring, but let's just say they agree with, then what will happen is you will see the person who is speaking, who is reinforcing the message that they want to get out, they will be dressed up in blue, decked out in blue. Because blue is calming, the voice of reason, and so on. So everything that they do is psychological. Everything they do has to do with conditioning and programming. And this is very difficult for a lot of people to get their heads wrapped around, that it's this orchestrated and it's this engineered. But I'm telling you, Ole, you know, I have been a hypnotherapist I'm in my seventh year of practice. I am really a student of it, and I see it, and I know exactly what's going on. So this is what they're doing. here in the United States, we have 6 companies control all of the media. So when people ask me about, well, how can it be that all of the media is controlled? I say, well, it's controlled by 6 companies, which means that 6 people can sit at a table or 6 people can be on a conference call and they can decide on what it is that you're going to see and what it is you're not going to see. And it's not news. It's not news. What it is, it's an agenda. It's an agenda that's being rolled out, and it's all propaganda in order to move that agenda forward. The other thing only that, you know, that they use is numbers. So it's very occulted too. And, you know, they love the numbers 3, 6, 66, 666, 7, 77, 8, 88, 11, 33. I mean, you're going to see this all the time. All the time on the news, in newspapers, and you're going to see it in timestamps on articles that are run on the internet. So you have to also take a look at the numbers. I have paid a lot of attention to it over the last couple of years, and based upon the numbers that are presented, I can easily pick up whether a story is true or fabricated. And unfortunately, most stories that we see are fabricated and engineered. Like with everything else, there is that subset which is very aware of it, and then there are all the others that are not aware of it. So they have to keep it in my mind. They have to keep those that are in the knowing. That little click has to be very small. That's how you're able to keep control. So I will tell you that anybody who is a prominent anchor person, they're in a secret society. So it's completely run by Freemasons, completely run by them. There's a great video that somebody who was an expert in neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, they broke down Sean Hannity several years back. And, you know, he took a typical Sean Hannity show, and he was breaking everything down, all of the way he was moving, his hands, the way he was speaking, and he was breaking it down. He said the whole thing is all NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, which is the way in order to get the audience or the listener to lean and think and move in a certain way. That's what NLP is about. So, again, there is the subset that is very much in the knowing. If they are a big name, anchor person, pundit, whatever, there's no question in my mind that these people do know. They know that they are part of a script. They are part of an engineered agenda, and they are in a secret society. They are most likely Freemasons and most likely in the 32nd and 33rd degree of Freemasonry.
You know, Mike, over the years, I've come to the conclusion that so many so-called accidents are also part of this strategy of tension. Is that your experience as well?
Well, I believe at the local level that some of the stories are clearly true, you know, that there are victims of shootings and rapes and stuff like that. But I also would never discount that they are not fabricating stories. I mean, one of a litmus test for me is, just ask the question, does anything ever good happen? But every time you turn on the television, right? I mean, you're watching the news, whether it be local news or national news, it's always negative. It's always somebody got killed. There's always war. There's always some dysfunctional, deplorable act that's taking place. And you have to think to yourself, are you going to tell me that nothing good in humanity happened today? So I think that that's one way in order to really start to understand that what's being presented to you for the most part, and I'm talking about 95 to like 98% of what you're watching on the news, whether it be, like, again, local or national, this stuff is fabricated, and if it's not completely fabricated, it's tainted in some way. So you really have to start thinking that way in order to really understand what's going on in the world. You know, I take a look at the newspapers coming out of the UK as an example, and Germany. You know, I look at them on the internet in English, and you're absolutely right. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. It's just those folks happen to be living in Germany or in England, and we're here in the United States, but the stories, they're all the same. And it's all about fear. It's to keep people in fear. Because if you're in fear, what happens is you're not going to critically think. You're going to be reactive, not proactive. You're going to be reactive. Fight or flight mode, if you will. And that's where they want to keep people. They want to keep you on your toes. They want you to be dancing around, ducking and, you know, weaving. And there's a boogeyman under your bed. And like you said, are you going to lose your pension or, you know, your bank account, your stocks? I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's really very, very twisted. And it's amazing to me that more and more people actually don't see it. In fact, you know, I've had conversation with folks and their attitude is, well, you know, Mike, it's just the way the world works. I'm like, oh my God, really? So, but this is their thought process. I mean, I don't know what to do about it because we just live in a very evil, bad world. And, you know, and I guess the next thought process they would have is, well, that's why we have authority. That's why we have politicians and the police and all that to take care of that stuff so that I can be safe. So it's a very difficult road that we're on, Oli, to be able to convince the masses to understand what's really going on and how the world really works. I think it's a natural progression because more and more people are starting to look into this stuff. And even if it's a cursory interest, they're looking for it. And they know that people are looking for this stuff. And the other thing that content providers have to be aware of is that YouTube, as an example, I have a YouTube account. We're playing in their backyard. I mean, they own these formats. These are their tools. And so when we use them and we over-invest in them, then we have to be very careful and not be surprised when they turn around and say, well, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to allow you to say that anymore. We're not going to allow this upload or this topic to be discussed. And the problem is that people want to talk about free speech and all that stuff. But here's the thing. Free speech does not apply when you have a contractual agreement between two entities, you and YouTube as an example. So when you sign up for a YouTube account, there are terms and conditions. And some of those terms and conditions, granted, are very ambiguous. But this is the thing. This is how it works, right? It's intentionally ambiguous so that when they want to screw around with your YouTube account, they can do that. Now, you know, I myself have had personal experiences where with certain interviews that I have, your interviews as an example, when we talk about false flags, Oli, they will sit on the view count for days. And then you wait a couple of days, 2 or 3 days, and then there's an uptick. I received a letter from my music publisher, and they wrote to me and they said, you know, dear Mike, we received a letter from YouTube. And we want to let you know that they had said that certain videos that you have on your YouTube channel cannot be monetized. Now, I don't have any monetization going on my YouTube channel. What they were telling me was, if you decide to monetize, the following videos will not be allowed to be monetized because of the topic that's being discussed. So, and this is going on, and I don't really know what the answer is, to be honest with you. I guess the thing to do would be for people to go create their own websites away from YouTube, as an example, and put their information or make sure their information is posted up there. But the problem is, it does not have the audience that YouTube has. YouTube, by far, it's gargantuan. It's gigantic. It is the venue for the alternative research community to get their information out there. I mean, there are other platforms that are out there, but they pale in comparison. There's no doubt about it. I mean, YouTube is now, they've teamed up with the ADL, okay, the Anti-Defamation League, to monitor content. They have this whole little program going on where the little herd mentality of programmed people can flag your material. And if they don't get you for copyright, they'll get you for community guideline violations, which is most of the time, very nebulous and very ambiguous. So these are the times that we live in. When you're pushing truth and you're fighting for truth, it's not going to be easy. These people, Oli, they have been in control for so long. They're not going to give it up. They're not going to roll over. They're not going to say, hey, you got me. Gig is up. It's okay. Okay, you guys run the show now. That's not going to happen. They are going to fight us. It's going to be a steel cage death match. So for those of us that are in the truth movement and the alternative research community, we have to suit up and understand that it's going to get more and more and more difficult, because they're just not going to give it up. They're not going to give up. You know, it's like this is their domain. This is where they thrive. And the system they have in place, the whole system of commerce, the whole system that's occulted and so on, they are rewarded handsomely for having this system in place. And for people who support it, that means they are rewarded with money, they are rewarded with titles, they are rewarded with positions of power and influence and affluence and so on. So, like I said, I'm not trying to be a dark cloud here, a big rain cloud. All I'm saying is that the truth community has got to stop whining about this stuff and has to understand that this is the nature of the beast. They own those platforms. And so we've got to get a little smarter about how to work around it and do things where we don't have to be as reliant on their tools. You know, and some of the truth community is saying, well, I'm going to move it over to Patreon. And I have a Patreon account too, and I've moved my stuff over to Patreon. So it's only a matter of time before the screws get turned on the Patreon accounts. So the one thing everybody has to understand is all of this stuff is controlled. All of it. Who controls Patreon, right? I haven't done any digging into it, but I'm sure if we start digging into it, we're going to understand, well, it's the same old players at the end of the day. So there's very little out there that they do not control. And if something does pop up that they do not control, that they don't have a handle on, in very short order, they'll make sure that they've got their hands in the pot. So it's really what it is. It's, you know, we have to stay on our toes because it's a perpetual motion machine of maneuvering and trying to outsmart and out-navigate each other. Look, my take on it is, like, again, with a lot of these truthers and alternative research channels, they made a big mistake by investing in those channels from a monetary perspective. And so when YouTube turned around and said, well, we're going to demonetize this, and that, a lot of folks were really complaining about the fact that, hey, you know, I'm not making any money at this anymore. Well, why were you invested in a tool that was owned by the enemy to begin with, and thinking that you were going to ride that gravy train? How long did you think you were going to ride that? Forever? Absolutely no way. In fact, that was probably part of the strategy of platforms like YouTube, to pull as many truthers and as many alternative research content providers onto the platform, knowing that they're invested in it. Some of them are invested very heavily in it, and then they're going to pull the plug. And a lot of these people are running around today in a death spiral, running around like a bunch of chickens without their heads, because I can't believe this happened. And then they want to complain about YouTube. But again, it's what I said in the beginning. You have a contract with them. When you have a YouTube account, you have a contract. And most people don't read that contract. But if you go back and take a look at it, you're going to find some content verbiage in that contract that you have with them. And you'll begin to understand why it is they can do what they can do. You may not like it, but that's neither here nor there, because they can do it.
You've been listening to the first hour of A Light on Conspiracies podcast. To access the second hour of this and all podcasts, please visit lightonconspiracies.com and get a membership for the price of a cup of coffee. Now, back to the show.
Another way to keep your material up there is to do what you and I are doing, which is to have a conversation-based type of format. And the reason is because it's a lot more difficult for them to plow through an hour and a half, or a two-hour conversation and dialogue talking about stuff versus content that's put up there that is specific. In other words, what a lot of content providers are doing is they're putting up a video and it says Sandy Hook, or it says Zionism, or it says Jews, or it says whatever. So basically what they're doing is that they've just put a big bullseye out there. Now, again, I'm not being an apologist for YouTube at all. I mean, I can't stand what YouTube is doing, because like I said, they have done things to my own channel. But all I'm saying is, I think maybe if we just change the approach a little bit and not make it like there is a big bullseye out there, that I think a lot of these channels might benefit from that. Because that's what they're doing. They're looking for, like, keywords is what they're looking for. And they're going to hone in on that. And that's why a lot of channels have really struggled, because they were talking about Sandy Hook, or they were talking about 9/11 as an example or whatever, and then they would use clips. Now, there is a fair use clause within the copyright laws, and many of the content providers on YouTube, they are using the media clips the right way within the fair use clause, but you know, YouTube doesn't care about that. So what they'll do is they'll look for those keywords, Sandy Hook and so on, and then boom, they dive right in and they'll take a look and they'll say, well, this is an easy one. We'll just give them a copyright strike for using, you know, CNN footage or for using NBC footage or some television show's footage, and that'll be that. And I know you and I probably follow some very similar YouTubers, and how many of those channels have just been struggling to be able to keep afloat? They keep getting strikes, one right after the other, and they have to create a new channel and have backup channels, and they just keep getting these strikes over and over and over again. So I think that maybe one way around this, without getting too long-winded here, is to change the approach a little bit to make it more difficult for them. Like, one of the things I don't do, Ole, is I do not use any kind of video footage from any news organization or any TV show or any of that stuff. Basically, when you listen to my shows, you're going to see a slideshow that I created myself using my own tools. In fact, I use PowerPoint, as crazy as that might sound, to be able to create my slides. This way, they can't come after me and say that I'm using copyrighted material. No, this is my material. These are my pictures. These are my words. So, I mean, that's another way to try to go about it.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about your music and how you got started?
Yeah, well, I started playing guitar in earnest, I would say, probably around 14 or 15 years old. Before that, I was kind of dabbling in it. Probably, I would say, around 8 or 9 years old. I remember my father having an acoustic guitar, and my brother and I would kind of play around with it a little bit. But it wasn't until probably, about 14 or 15 years old where I really wanted to play, and, you know, playing electric guitar. And my brother had built a homemade amplifier. He still is very good with electronics and stuff like that. So we would play that in my garage, and he had a drum kit, and we would do some basic songs and so on. We mostly made a lot of noise. But then, you know, throughout into the late 1970s, into the 1980s, I was writing original music, and I was trying to get the music. Well, I was trying to get assigned as a band. And then after that, I was trying to get songs published. The band piece of it fell by the wayside because at some point, you know, you're not making any money. You have to be able to go, quote unquote, get a real job so that you can pay the bills. So the people that were in the band, including myself, we had to go do other stuff. And so the whole band thing kind of dissipated. But I was still trying to get the music published. I was still writing music. And then in the 1990s, my brother had a small four-track studio in his home in Maryland, and I would drive down. I live in North Carolina. Would drive up for the weekend, and we used to call it Weekend Warrior Recordings, and we would bang out a song over the weekend. They actually came out quite good. He had a great setup there. And then I had a long period of time where I was still playing. You know, I had my guitars, but I wasn't doing any recording. I was knee deep in my career. I worked for I was in the corporate world. I was in the corporate world for a very long time, over 30 years. And then I guess I approached into 2011, I decided that I was going to write an album. After a long, long period of time where I wasn't writing music, I was still playing, but I wasn't writing original stuff. And so in 2011, I sat down and I wrote an album, and it's called Leaving Dystopia, and I released it in, I think it was early 2013 is when I released the album. I did it all at home. I have a home recording studio. It's a small studio, 24-track Tascam recorder. And then after that, as of right now, I'm knee-deep in finishing up the songs for a second album, which I'm hoping to release by the end of this year. And that's basically it, Ole. And the songs on Leaving Dystopia and the songs that will be on the new album, which is going to be entitled Hollow Moon, it's going to talk a lot about the realities of the world that we live in and hopefully be some food for thought for the listener. Music is a very powerful tool, as you know, because I know you have some great music yourself. Folks, a lot of people don't know this, but Ole has some great songs that he released himself. And you and I know that, you know, music can really raise the consciousness and raise the awareness. And that's one of the reasons why the controllers control the music industry, because they know how powerful music is.
Okay, Mike, it's time for the big mystery. Paul McCartney or Paul McCartney? This is something that has been surrounded by mystery and rumors since the very day that it said it happened in the 1966. Were you aware of this?
Yeah. In fact, Ollie, I was one of those people that was aware of the conspiracy, Paul McCartney, biological Paul McCartney, dying back in 1966. But, you know, like a lot of other people, I just didn't think it was credible, and I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. I did poke my head into it on and off over the years. In fact, back in high school, back in 1976, I had organized a Paul is Dead Clues type of little presentation. And so I was very aware of it, but I really did not dig into it to the extent that, looking back, that I should have. Because now that I have looked into it, it's pretty obvious that biological Paul, or the original Paul McCartney, was replaced back in September of 1966. What supposedly happened was, late September 11th, 1966, Paul McCartney was leaving the studio, and he had received song assignments from Brian Epstein. And based upon the book, The Memoirs of Billy Shears by Tom U. Harriott, which I recommend that anybody who is into the Paul is Dead conspiracy read the book. It's an exceptional book. He had an argument with Brian Epstein about the song assignments. I guess perhaps it had to do with the number of songs and so on, and maybe the period of time in which Paul had to get the songs written and ready to be recorded. And so he was driving his car, and it was raining, and along the way he had picked up a hitchhiker, a lady. And the way the story goes is that on his way back home, he was in a car accident. And it was a very bad car accident, and he was decapitated, or at least his head was severely, severely damaged in the accident. And he died. And, of course, the Beatles at that point in time were at the pinnacle, top of the heap of music, rock music at the time, and they were making a lot of people a lot of money. And as I'll discuss as we go along this conversation, they were and still are a Tavistock project. And so they had to find a replacement. And the replacement that came in is a guy by the name of William Wallace Shepherd, Bill Shepherd. And again, this is coming from the book, The Memoirs of Billy Shears. Some people will refer to him as William Campbell, Billy Shears. Billy Shears was an alias that was used for Sgt. Pepper, which was the first album that Bill Shepherd played on, and that was his album. And so that's what happened. The biological Paul allegedly died September 11th, 1966. Some will argue it was November 9th or sometime in August. I always tell folks I don't get very concerned about the dates. I'm more focused on the Tavistock PSYOP because I think that's far more important than whether he died in August or September or November. Well, in the book, again, folks, I'm going to be referring to The Memoirs of Billy Shears. In the book is written in first person. Let me just say this. Tom U. Harriott is the author, but Tom is like a ghostwriter. The person who's speaking in first person is Bill Shepherd. And it's like reading his memoir. It's reading about his life story, how he came to be, how he joined the Beatles, and so on. So in the book, he openly talks about Tavistock and their connections into the Beatles, but not just the Beatles, but also the Rolling Stones and others. He discusses how EMI, which was the record label that the Beatles were on, and EMI stands for Electric and Musical Industries, had connections into British intelligence. So EMI was a British multinational music recording, publishing, and electronics company that was headquartered in London. And it was in existence from 1931 until 2011. And after 2011, all that material moved over to Sony. They owned Parlophone Records, which was the label that the Beatles first recorded on. So if you go back to the original label of Please Please Me, which, by the way, was released on March 22nd, 1963. So March 22nd, 322, which is the numbers associated with Skull and Bones. And that he states in the book that he worked with the CIA and British intelligence via the MKUltra program in the 1960s to promote LSD, and specifically promoting it with the Monterey International Pop Festival, which took place in 1967, which was also known as the Summer of Love. So there's a lot of information that's divulged in the book from this person, Bill Shepherd, who is claiming that he is Paul McCartney. He's been playing the part of Paul McCartney since September of 1966, so for 50 plus years. He's been the guy that we've been looking at and listening to. But Tavistock in itself, Tavistock was actually came into being as known as the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations in 1921. And then in 1947, it formed what we refer to today as the Tavistock Institute. It's headquartered in London. It has ties to British Freemasonry. Tavistock was developed for mass brainwashing. Its experiments in crowd control methods have been widely used on the American public. It has developed such power in the U.S., Tavistock that is, that no one achieves prominence in any field in the U.S., and I'm assuming in other Western countries, unless that person has been trained in behavioral science at Tavistock or one of its subsidiaries. And one of the single common denominators that identifies Tavistock's strategy, Ole, is the use of drugs. So the result was, as an example I mentioned before, the LSD counterculture of the 1960s, the quote-unquote student revolutions, which was financed by Tavistock and the CIA to the tune of $25 million. Tavistock has an extensive network that it works with and works through the University of Sussex in England, and also in the U.S., working with Stanford Research, the Esalen Institute, which is commonly just called Esalen, which is an American retreat center, and a lot of the new age types of spiritual, humanistic, alternative education comes out of Esalen. MIT, Hudson Institute, Heritage Foundation, many high-level personnel and corporations are required to undergo indoctrination at one of or more of these Tavistock-controlled institutes. So the point being with Tavistock is it's in the business of mind control, it's in the business of social engineering and mass mind manipulation. And that's what they do. And they run, you know, their experiments and their initiatives and their projects to steer the collective consciousness in a certain direction. Because what they're looking to do is they're looking to shape thoughts, ideas, values, norms, and so on. So that's what Tavistock is about. It is a very powerful organization. If you look it up on Google, it's going to say a whole lot of nice things about it. You know, their guru was Sigmund Freud. And there's a great book out there if you want to learn more about it by Daniel Estulin. It's called Tavistock Institute, Social Engineering the Masses. So that might be a book that the audience might want to take a look at. But yeah, I mean, that's what they're into, Ole, mind control and social engineering.
We're coming to the end of the first hour, and I would very much like to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today, Mike. So I'm sure that quite a few people are interested in getting in touch with you and maybe book sessions for hypnosis or learn more about different topics. Would you mind sharing the details on how people can get in touch with you?
The best way to contact me with regard to the Sage of Quay material is to go to my hub website. And that is Sage of Quay, it's Q-U-A-Y, sageofquay.com. So going there, because it is a hub website, you'll be able to get to my radio shows on YouTube, Mixcloud, Twitter, and all that stuff. My email is there if you want to contact me. And then my hypnosis practice is Imagine Hypnotics, and it's imaginehypnotics.com. And I do both clinical and spiritual hypnosis. And I've been in practice now for 7 years, and I love doing the work only because it's one of those fields where you can help people. And the benefits of helping them is spontaneous. Once they have that session and you're working with them, you get them to quit smoking, or if they want to lose weight or de-stress or be able to better manage pain, or have them have a spiritual experience. I mean, it's very powerful stuff.
To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe. Give yourself the gift of truth and awareness while supporting Ole's hard efforts to get it out there.
May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.